Session number 28743.
Hugh Richardson, Reel 1. Could we start with when and where you were born, please?
Yes, indeed. I was born in Kilmarnock in Ayrshire, and I was born on the 16th of July, 1916. I was educated at Kilmarnock Academy, and I was educated with a view to becoming a Presbyterian minister. My mother was very keen that I should become that, and I took 5 years of classics and with that in view. I took classical Greek and Latin. Unfortunately, my father died at an early age, and I was unable to continue my studies at classical university. I was told by an uncle of mine that I could not go on playing cricket and golf for the rest of my life and not working, so he persuaded me to visit a greyhound racecourse that had opened in Kilmarnock. In 1932, the Americans brought greyhound racing into Britain, and racecourses mushroomed. They sprang up all over the country and were very successful. And they opened one in Kilmarnock, and my uncle took shares in it because the shares were paying enormous dividends. And he said to me, "Hugh, you cannot go on wasting your life like this. You've got to earn a living. You're 17 years old, and it's time you started to do so." So he took me up to this greyhound racecourse and introduced me to the management. And they said, "Yes, you can start as a timekeeper," which means that you will be holding a stopwatch in both hands, and you will time the greyhound racing. So I started as that, and I found it quite interesting, obviously. And I was working for the racing manager in his office and learning how to handicap greyhounds and put them in races. That lasted about a year, but unfortunately the man who was racing manager, Mr. Learmont, became very ill with consumption, and he had to leave. And I was called into the director's office, and they said, "Richardson, you've learned enough about this business now in a year. You're now going to become the racing manager." And I said, "But racing manager, don't you think I'm a bit young to take the responsibility of that?" And he said, No. You've proved that you can cope with the business, and you're now the racing manager and act accordingly." So that was surprising, to get a quick promotion like that. Well, I stayed there about 2 years as racing manager, and then I was sent to a holiday race course in Aberdeen. It was only open for 8 months of the year because the climate up there is not conducive to running greyhounds in the winter time. So it was a nice job, really, because I had 8 months working ability and then 4 months off on pay, so there was nothing wrong with that. So I stayed there, and it was very enjoyable. It was a pretty little race course, and it was meant really for the, obviously, for the holiday makers. And all company-owned greyhounds, very straightforward. And I was there for the next 3 years. I had an amazing contact with a man called Captain Brian Fairfax Lucy. He was the son-in-law of John Buchan, and he eventually went to Canada when John Buchan became Viscount Tweedsmuir and Governor-General of Canada. Well, I became very friendly with the captain, and we were good friends. And he said, "Hugh," he said, "you're wasting your time in Aberdeen. You must come down to London and join one of the companies who have more than one race course and go on from there." And I said, "Well, yes, I'd like to go to London." So he arranged it for me, and I came down to London, and I met a man called Henry Garland Wells, one of the biggest solicitors in London. He had offices in Norfolk House, Strand. And to my surprise, because I was still only 19 or 20 at the time, 19 actually, he said to me, yes, he said, you've had the necessary experience. There is a vacancy on my staff at Reading, and you go back to Scotland for the moment, and I will send for you when it's coming to the time when we shall require you. So I was very pleased, obviously, to get a very quick job in London, or with a London company. And I came down eventually, and I went to as rating manager at Reading. And then, of course, along came the war, and greyhound racing was stopped, obviously, because of the lighting. And then a man called Morrison, who was the Home Secretary at the time, had the vision to say, well, the people have got to have entertainment. We will allow greyhound racing in daylight. Obviously, it cannot be floodlit because of the blackout. And we will allow it to be run in the afternoons, which was a very good decision by somebody who really, really was doing his job. Anyway, greyhound racing started again in the afternoons, but by that time, the war was coming very much nearer, and it meant that I didn't want to stay in greyhound racing, so I wondered what I should do. Well, when I was a bit younger, I used to practice what was called in those days wireless telegraphy, and I thought, well, yes, Marconi. There are vacancies on the ships by the Marconi company, and I shall train myself at a college and achieve the necessary speed in Morse and hope that Marconi will take me on. Well, I achieved the speed, which is 25 words a minute in Morse, to read and send Morse. And I achieved that, and I got a certificate from the college, and Marconi said, yes, you can join our company. And then I joined the Merchant Navy as a radio officer.
When was it you joined Marconi?
I joined Marconi in 1940. And I went to Liverpool, and I was sent to join a ship which was lying in Cardiff, the Nalon, SS Nalon, N-A-L-O-N. So I joined as the second radio officer, obviously, and the Nalon. Well, the Nalon's voyage was unfortunate, to say the least of it. We started off and we sailed up the Irish Sea, and I remembered as a schoolboy going round on the paddle steamers round Ailes of Craig and over to Arran, but this was different. We were joining a convoy at Oban. A large convoy was gathering at Oban, and we joined it. We went out into the Atlantic. Well, the Atlantic in 1940 was the most dangerous place that you could possibly sail in. The number of ships sunk in the year 1940 was astronomical. U-boats were hunting in packs, and they were sinking the ships right, left, and center. The Navy was struggling to protect the convoys, but it was a hopeless task for them, that the convoys were so large, and their escort vessels were few and far between. The Navy had run down, and they were even pressing merchant ships into service as convoy ships, as commodore of a convoy, because they just did not have the vessels. Anyway, as I say, the year 1940 was the worst year of the war for the sinking in the convoys. They didn't publicise the sinkings, obviously, and the public in Britain were unaware of the serious nature of the situation. There was one publication of a sinking which shocked the whole nation. It was a ship called the SS Athenia. And she was a very fast liner, and they thought that her speed would make her safe from the U-boats. They could never have been quite so wrong. They packed her with school children who were being evacuated to Canada for their safety, and these poor parents put their children on board this of the SS Athenia, and she was 3 days out from Liverpool, and she was sunk by a torpedo. The terrible loss of life, as you can imagine, and these parents must have been devastated, because they were thinking they were sending their children to safety, and instead of that, fate dealt them a terrible blow. Anyway, that was a very tragic occasion. The Nalon and the convoy she was in carried on. We went down to South Africa, which, strangely enough, the Nalon was owned by the Union Castle Line, and that was on normal run. In peacetime, she would take 12 passengers and cargo, so that she went on a run was Cape Town and Durban. Well, this was the same run that the convoy followed, and we went to Cape Town. Beautiful place, Cape Town. I fell in love with it when I saw it from Table Bay. And then we went round the Cape, Simonstown, the naval base on the Cape, and we went up to Lorenzo Marques, which is was situated then in Portuguese East Africa. We took on a very unusual cargo in Lorenzo Marques, and that cargo was going to prove our undoing later in the voyage. It consisted of large copper ingots, which looked like giant chocolate bars, but they were tremendously heavy, and it meant that they could only load so many into each hold, and they couldn't put cargo in the hold with them, which meant that the holds were unusually empty on top of these copper ingots. We went back to Cape Town, and then we sailed across the South Atlantic to New York. America was not in the war at that point, and I can remember my first experience as a radio officer was a terrifying one, because we were off coming up to nearing Bermuda, and I was on my what they call the dog watch in the Merchant Navy, the midnight to 6 a.m. And I was on my watch, and I was pretty horrified when I got a signal from Land's End Radio with our call sign. Now, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was quite aware that Land's End Radio would not send me a signal to give me a weather report. This was business. And I was terrified that the signal was drifting, and I was afraid to adjust the receiver too much in case I lost it altogether. But I'd adjusted it slightly and got a better signal, and I managed to take down the message. Well, the messages in those days were in code, obviously, five-letter codes, and I took the groups of five letters down on a messenger pad, and I was so relieved when it came to end of message, and I had all the groups on my pad. I desperately grabbed the bag in which the code books were there to decipher the codes, and I got the code books out, and I deciphered this message, and I was quite right, it was important. It said from Land's End to Nalon, there is a U-boat in your vicinity, alter course immediately for Bermuda. Now, end of message. So I hurriedly got the pad torn off and sent it by the seaman on watch up to the bridge, and we altered course right away for Bermuda. We got to Bermuda safely, and we anchored there, and we stayed there for a night and a day. So, and then we proceeded to New York. Well, New York, as I say, America was not in the war at that stage, and New York was quite an experience. I sailed past the Statue of Liberty as dawn broke one morning, and I could see the magical Manhattan skyline that I'd seen so much of in the cinemas, and this was real. And we birthed in New York. As I have said, America was not in the war, and in New York the World's Fair was on. So that we had, I had some short leave, and I went and visited the New York World's Fair, magnificent fair, as Americans so great, do everything in style, lagoons and pavilions and everything you could think of. That was very interesting. Then the Nalon sailed again, and we went down the coast to Philadelphia and Boston. Well, because America was not in the war, there was of course no blackout on the towns along the coast. And this was dangerous, highly dangerous, because we were silhouetted for the U-boats against this lighting. But we got safely down to Philadelphia, and the powers that be decided that it was much too dangerous to go back the way we'd come. So they put this ship, which was 13,000 tons, into the inland waterways, which I don't think had ever been done before. And we had to lower the mast and do various things so that we'd get under the bridges. It was quite incredible. And the people turned out to see this British ship of that tonnage going up their waterways. Well, we negotiated the waterways all right, and we got back to New York. Well, we set off from New York for the UK, the convoy.
Just before we start with that voyage, could I ask what the morale was like on this first voyage with the
morale was quite very good on the ship, because at that stage we were all relatively inexperienced about wartime convoys, and we didn't, I'm sure, realize the dangers that we were running. The Americans actually were paying their merchant seamen extra money to go into the danger zones, believe it or not. And we were rather annoyed about that, because we had a very low wage, obviously. But that's by the way. Yes, morale was fairly high, and it was an excellent ship's complement. It was a peacetime complement, really, because we even had stewards, which was quite unusual. And we were occupying passenger cabins, so we were very comfortable. And the captain had a clerk who was called the captain's dip, because that goes back to the days of the quill pens. And Union Castle ran a very good, tight ship. So we were very comfortable, and the morale was good. Well, we set off from New York in a convoy for the UK. And there were no alarms on the first part of the voyage, but as we approached the UK, we were about, I should imagine, 3 or 4 days out. One morning, we had a big surprise. A four-engined aircraft arrived over the convoy, and we obviously thought must be one of ours, because at that time, Germany conquered enough of the continent to have bases in the continent. And this was a Fokker Wolf four-engine aircraft, and was obviously able to have fuel tanks to take her out well into the Atlantic. We thought we were reasonably safe where we were, but that was our misfortune. He didn't do that. This aircraft did not do the normal dummy run, which they do to estimate a ship's speed. He immediately went round the convoy and came down the centre line. Well, the Nalon was third in line. He dropped bombs. He tried to drop bombs on the first two ships, and they missed. But when he came to the Nalon, he dropped a bomb which struck the starboard wing of the bridge, did not explode, fell in the water, exploded in the water, and blew the ship's side in. And then, of course, the business about the cargo came into play, because the empty holds above these copper ingots, these tremendously heavy ingots, the holds were empty, and the Atlantic rushed in very, very quickly. And when the bomb exploded, she broke her back, as they say in the description, and it was obvious that she was going to sink fairly quickly. The captain gave the normal instruction, abandon ship, and we went to the lifeboats. Well, Fortunately, as she developed a list, she listed to port, and we were able to launch the port lifeboats. And a destroyer, HMS Viscount, who was one of the escorts of the convoy, fortunately came back for us. They didn't always do that, but he came back and he hove to about, I should imagine, about 80 or 90 yards away from the ship, because he didn't come too close. As she was going down, it creates an enormous suction, and he was afraid of that, of course, and he was not very happy about being hove to with the U-boats around. So he was yelling at us from the bridge, "Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up." And we rowed the lifeboats across to the destroyer. You have scramble nets hanging down the side of the destroyer. Scrambled up the nets, and fortunately, all of the crew were saved. Some of them had been in watch in the engine room, had broken their arms and had bad burns when the pipes, so the live steam came out. That's the big danger in an engine room. But they got safely into the lifeboats, and we all boarded the destroyer. Well, we must have been about 3 days out, and she rejoined the convoy, obviously, and we sailed on towards Liverpool. There was another alarm with a U-boat. The ASDIC equipment picked up a signal, and action stations on the destroyer. And with all these, the members of our crew, which must have been 50 or 60 people, on board the destroyer, the poor seamen had a job when they were going for action stations. But they managed to do it. And depth charges were thrown into the sea, of course. And the submarine must have been fairly deep. There was no sign of the U-boat. And we sailed on. We came into Liverpool, and they tested our engines down the... There's a measured mile outside Liverpool where they test the ship's engines. And this destroyer, HMS Viscount, was fairly old, one of the old class. But she reached 30 knots, 32 knots, I think, was the speed coming down the measured mile. And that was quite a thrill. To stand on board a destroyer's deck when she's up to 32 knots is quite something. She comes alive. And then, of course, she birthed in Liverpool. And our captain, who was a man called Captain Berry, was R&R. He was very proud of it. And before she went alongside, he gathered the officers in the wardroom and made us sing Land of Hope and Glory, which was a fitting end to a voyage that came to an end like that.
Was he the captain of the Viscount, or...?
He was the captain of the Nalon. Yes, captain of the Nalon. He was R&R, and of course that means he was very conscious of the uniform and the Navy styles. And that was the end of the Nalon's voyage.
Was yours the only ship sunk in that convoy?
Yes. As far as I know, we were the only one, because after the after he tried to bomb the first two in line, he was successful in bombing us, he disappeared, and I don't think any of the other ships were attacked. We were lucky and unlucky, because if the bomb had exploded on the bridge, I was on the bridge with the captain and the helmsman, we would not have survived, obviously not. But it was unlucky that it went off, the bomb went off in the sea, and she broke her back. And because of the cargo, the sinking was accelerated, obviously, with the empty holds. With cargo in the holds, it would have taken a little bit longer. But these copper ingots were our undoing in this particular example. And that was the end of the unfortunate Nalon.
When you were in America, how were you received by the Americans?
That's an interesting point. I was foolish enough to go ashore in a British uniform, similar to this, but with mold braid on it. And the atmosphere in New York was hostile, believe it or not. When I say hostile, they were obviously at that stage, they were not in the war. I don't think a lot of the Americans wanted to be in the war. And the sight of a British uniform was not to their taste, I found. So I did not do that again. I went ashore in a civilian suit. But I thought it was rather obvious that they were not war-minded. Let's put it no stronger than that. And Winston Churchill, of course, had long time to persuade Roosevelt to enter the war, and Pearl Harbor did it for him. The Americans came into the war after Pearl Harbor, but not until. So I mustn't overstate the case, but I didn't think the American attitude then was on our side. I'll put it no stronger than that. And it took Pearl Harbor to bring them in.
And you were in Cape Town. How were the South Africans?
They were all right. Yes, they were. That was I loved Cape Town. It was a lovely place. Beautiful climate. And they were friendly, very friendly. Yes.
Could you describe what an average day, as it were, would have been on the Nalon?
On the Nalon, an average day.
For your position.
In my position. Well, there were two radio officers, first and second, and they did 6 hours on and 6 hours off. So that meant the day was divided into four watches, and the second radio officer, with myself, would do what they call the dog watch, because of its midnight to 6 a.m. But I didn't find that any hardship, because it was you got used to it, and it's like someone on a job with a night shift. And I did that for most of the time I was at sea, 12 to 6. And the Union Castle ran a very tight ship and very good ships, and the food was excellent, and the class of their officers was very high, which is not always the case on merchant ships. The next ship I was on had an Indian crew. Whilst they were quite efficient at what they did, it was a big change just to have white officers and an Indian crew. But the Union Castle, they were all white, and excellent crew. As I say, the captain even retained his captain's dip, which was rather unusual.
What would you do, you and the rest of the crew, do when you weren't on the watches?
Well, you've got watches on deck, of course. You've got your helmsman on the bridge, of course, and other people would be doing various tasks, and it was, as I say, a very tight run ship, very good discipline, and Captain Berry saw to that, being an R&R, and I had an amusing, but at the time it did not amuse me. We were in the Red Sea, and the temperature was 135, and I was wearing a white drill uniform, which has two buttons to secure the neck, and it was, as you can imagine, raging hot, and I was due on the bridge, because I was going to be in charge of the oldest signalling lamp, which you use to communicate with other ships, and I went on the bridge, and I had undone the top button of my collar, and I could feel Captain Berry looking at me, and he said, "You do not come on my bridge improperly dressed. I'm going to log you for that, for one button at the top of my collar," which gives you an idea of the man's attitude to uniform. Yes.